Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now is Hugh Hewitt, the syndicated radio host heard locally on AM 970 and an NBC News and MSNBC commentator. He has worked in the Reagan administration, helped Richard Nixon, Dan Quayle, and Mitt Romney write books, and worked for the National Endowment for the Humanities and the California Arts Council, among other things. He's a Republican who calls President Obama's policies disastrous, but also called on Donald Trump to quit the campaign after the Access Hollywood tape came out in October, but has come back around to thinking he has the potential for a great presidency. And Hugh Hewitt is a big thinker on the issues, and he has a new book called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. We'll explore his Fourth Way philosophy and talk about the news. Hugh, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, I'm really honored. I just put out a tweet saying, you've been doing this as long as I have. I started in radio in 1989, and you're a pro's pro and a Peabody winner, and it's very nice of you to have me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the directness and lack of sort of confrontational hyperbole with which you approach cable TV, and we need more of that.
Thank you.
Can we enter at the point when you called on Trump to drop out? You had also said previously that Trump was flying the party into the side of a mountain when he attacked Judge Curiel just for being Mexican-American. Obviously, you didn't want Hillary Clinton to become president. So what was going through your mind at that moment that you called on Trump to drop out?
This was an extraordinary year, culminating in that moment and then culminating in an election night. If there was a concussion protocol for the media, we'd all still be in it, like the NFL. I always swore to support the party nominee. I was a debate participant for four of the debates. So I was Switzerland throughout the primaries. I never endorsed anybody. And so I endorsed Mr. Trump. When he attacked Judge Curiel, when he was Mr. Trump, now he's President Trump, I said, that's the plane into the mountain. You can't attack a federal judge based on ethnicity. I'm a lawyer, and I understood that. Then he stopped. And so I went out and I campaigned for him. Access Hollywood jarred me. I suggested he get out of the race. I called on him to get out of the race. When he didn't, I said I'd vote for him. And I did. I may have been the only person in NBC and 30 Rock on the night of the election to have voted for Donald Trump. And I am happy with the way he is governing, though stylistically, I have a lot of changes I would suggest to him. I think he's going to get better at this, Brian, and I am hopeful.
Your framing of a political fourth way is a riff on the third way, one of the nicknames for President Bill Clinton's brand of being a new Democrat in the 90s. You're harshly critical of the third way movement in the book. Why is that?
Because I thought it really concealed a genuine leftism with sugar coating. Bill Clinton was as liberal as President Obama turned out to be, but he sugarcoated it much better than President Obama did. President Obama was honest and absolutely direct about what he wanted to do. And like Corbyn in Great Britain, was a third-way leader who said, no, we're actually going back to FDR and we're going to build the government.
Corbyn is like the Bernie Sanders of the UK, right?
Yes, he's authentically a socialist. And to a certain extent, the march that was so vastly successful on Saturday here and in Washington across the country was a third-way march with a first-way core. It was run by first-way Democrats, big government Democrats, but it drew in a lot of people who were upset by Donald Trump, so it was a third-way march. The fourth way says to the president and to the Republicans, co-opt the center, go for the center, grab it, hang on to it, and build a lasting majority.
Right. And you knock it in the book as elitist, but a Clinton supporter would say it wasn't about elitism at all or sugarcoating, you know, real lefty policies, but about Democrats acknowledging at that time that conservatives got some things right, that crime was out of control, that too much socialism and too much protectionism really did hurt workers, and the third way modernized liberalism for political gain, of course, because Dukakis and Mondale and everybody were losing elections. Same with Tony Blair in the UK. But why not see it as genuine in that respect?
Because it didn't last. For example, the third way, Bill Clinton's greatest third way moment was when he signed welfare reform after vetoing it twice. President Obama undid a lot of the Bill Clinton welfare reform package that Mickey Kaus and others put together, taking the sugar coating off and adding, for example, repealing lifetime limits on welfare recipients. So I think he took the party back to a more genuine first way approach. And the fourth way to me is, okay, he left the center. Let's go take it and stay in the majority for a long period of time. Not sure that my conservative brethren will agree with me. It seems to me that President Trump began that way, meeting yesterday with the building unions, Brian. That's a big deal.
We talked about it last hour and getting Bernie Sanders to come out on CNN last night and say nice things about him and said if he wants to, cancel trade agreements that aren't in the interest of American workers and do things like that, then I'm going to support him on those points even as I oppose him on others.
Yeah. The fourth way begins with the great inventor of the fourth way is actually Alexander Hamilton, but more recently it's film director Rob Reiner. Rob passed Prop 10 in California 18 years ago, which took cigarette taxes and gave them to local people, and I've served on a Prop 10 board for 18 years, to use on infrastructure benefiting children 0 to 5 and make them healthy and ready to learn by the time they go to school.
This is fourth way? That doesn't sound conservative.
Oh, it's very conservative because it's 9 people from the local community who serve for no money with no bureaucratic oversight, and we do what we think is best for our community. It's federalism. And we've established dental clinics and swimming pools and autism centers. And if Donald Trump takes Rob Reiner's playbook, give the infrastructure funding that he has demanded and promised to local boards, and I argue this in the fourth way, he'll hit home run after home run. There will be tangible Trump trophies across the country.
You also pronounced George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism dead. Reaganism in pastels, you called it. Also ill-conceived, in your opinion?
No, I'm a big fan of W. I'm a Catholic social justice guy. And so when you merge conservative governance with Catholic social justice theology, you end up with W's compassionate conservatism and his father's 1,000 points of light. Never executed very well. Never executed very well.
Might not have wound up with the Iraq War, though, from a Catholic social justice perspective?
Well, I've had some conversations about that with people like Archbishop Chaput, and I haven't talked about it with with Cardinal O'Connor, but it does seem to me just war does apply there, and it does not exclude, Catholic social justice does not exclude robust national security actions.
One way or the other.
One way or the other. And it might not have been a wise decision. I won't replay it because we can't replay history, but it wouldn't exclude it necessarily.
And just to finish the thumbnail history, Obama, in the book, you call his policies disastrous. But he ends his time in office quite popular. And his supporters say, okay, Obamacare is flawed, but got 20 million people health insurance, needs to be fixed. The stimulus and even the TARP prevented the Great Recession from becoming another Great Depression, and he avoided getting the U.S. embroiled in yet another Middle East quagmire, despite the obvious horrors of Syria that everyone agrees are so horrific. So why disastrous from your point of view?
Well, let's start from the point of view of the Democratic Party. Down 12 senators in the Senate, down 54 members of Congress, down 14 state houses, down 900 legislative seats at the state and local
level. Politically disastrous.
In terms of the courts, the brokenness of the Senate process for confirming judges, the Harry Reid rule, which will now haunt Democrats, the simple majority approval, disastrous for the institutional check that the Senate has been. Disastrous even for the way that we talk to people. Now, Axelrod's my pal. He comes on my show a lot. I love to have him on. He's a Cubs fan. I'm an Indians fan.
Obama's old campaign manager.
Yeah, but I think the conversation sort of broke during President Obama's years. He began, if you'll recall, the week before he became president, meeting with George Will and Charles Krautheimer and Bill Kristol. And then the music stopped. The conversation ended. He told Eric Cantor famously, "We won, you lost." And there wasn't ever any bipartisanship. And that's why Obamacare doesn't work. It had no Republican input.
That we won, you lost. If I remember correctly, and maybe I don't, but that was at a televised meeting with Republicans in Congress after the pushback to the stimulus and maybe Obamacare had begun. And, you know, certainly the Democrats would say the conversation stopped when Mitch McConnell and the other leaders decided we won't go along with any kind of compromise on anything. Things that came out as formerly Republican-centrist, center-right policies like cap and trade and an individual mandate.
The famous McConnell statement, my objective, number one objective, beating him is 2 years after that meeting. You're right. It was televised. Eric Cantor Paul Ryan and John Boehner were invited to the Oval or to the Roosevelt Room, I can't remember, for to give their ideas. And Eric gave some ideas. Cantor gave some ideas. And the president said, no, we won, you lost. We're not doing that. Unfortunate. So was the entire 8 years of bitter partisanship. You cannot fix health care unless both parties agree. There are ways to do it. And by the way, the president's idea about extending children on their parents' insurance at 26 is going to get kept. I saw last night on Greta Van Susteren's show, Kevin Brady, who's chairman of Ways and Means, saying we're going to keep that. We're not going to allow people to exclude pre-existing conditions. But we're going to have a national marketplace, and we're going to slim down the mandatory benefits package. It could work, Brian. It could work. And I think Democrats might be more afraid of it working than it failing.
Hugh Hewitt is my guest. His new book is called The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. We can take some phone calls for him. Maybe you see him on television. Maybe you hear him on the radio. Maybe you just want to react to what you're hearing right now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So how different from Reaganism is fourth way conservatism?
It's fairly significantly different. It does have the same defense buildup. President Trump has promised and will execute a 350-ship Navy, an expansion of the Marine Corps. I think General Mattis, General Flynn are superb appointments. But it is significantly different on trade. I am a free trader. I would have signed the TPP. I would have said, Yahoo, go on in. I don't believe in border adjustment taxes. I think that is a nightmare that gets close to Smoot-Hawley. There will be disagreements. So President Reagan, whom I served in the White House, you're kind enough to mention I was a young briefcase-carrying lawyer, sharing an office with the now Chief Justice, laboring away in obscurity when he was the smartest guy in the room. You didn't have to do much. He will be significantly alike on judges. So it's definitely a shotgun marriage of, and that's what the fourth way is all about. What do conservatives like me want from a nationalist like Donald Trump? And we can work together to, that's Hamiltonian. He is very Hamiltonian, and I'm looking forward to that.
You write that the fourth way is most pressingly about a rollback of the vast and growing regulatory state.
Yes.
And we saw President Trump put a moratorium on regulations as one of his first acts. Are there certain kind of regulations that you find the most onerous in a big picture way? Is there a way to put, you know, because there are a lot of listeners who don't work in industries that are regulated in a way that they feel. So they roll their eyes and they think, rollback regulations, that's just a sop to the owners to make more money relative to the safety of their workers or the environment. So what are these onerous regulations?
That's so observant. We work in a business that's not regulated.
Right.
You and I are in the First Amendment protected media, so we're not regulated. But I was a lawyer and still am for 30 years for landowners. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are an iron triangle of non-development interests, and they prohibit the use of land. If you allow the use of land in a constructive way, not recklessly, but just in a constructive way, jobs are generated. For every house, for every construction industry job, there are four other jobs generated. Housing starts and building starts are the future. The building industry is to the country what GM and Ford and Chrysler were to the country in the 50s. We have to unleash it. Those three agencies in their obstacles to the productive use of land in an environmentally responsible way is the heart of the fourth way.
And you mentioned before the meeting between Trump and the construction union leaders yesterday. All of those leaders endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Right.
You call for spending on a specific sort of infrastructure. What sort?
I believe in buildings. I believe in public health clinics. I believe in swimming pools for underclass and underserved areas because of the lack of facilities that exist in places like Santa Ana, California, where we've poured a lot of money, or Garden Grove, California, or the Motel Children of Anaheim. I believe in the old school WPA. And I told the story this morning. My first job was in a WPA pool in Niles, Ohio. It's a WPA on it. It's still working.
That doesn't sound like Ronald Reagan.
It could be if you let local people decide what to do with their money. All you have to do is let local people decide. I asked my liberal friend, Jonathan Alter comes on. Jonathan, what happened to that $850 billion stimulus? Well, we repaved Route 3 in New Jersey. Show me a building, Brian. Can anything come to mind that is left behind of a $850 billion stimulus?
So you don't mind spending the $850 billion, maybe especially under those dire economic circumstances, but it should have been left more to the local communities, or I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you're getting close. It went to bureaucracy and not to buildings. It went to pension funds and to organized labor, especially in the public sector, and not to buildings. And so I think it was a waste. And I don't want to spend $850 billion. Leader Schumer unveiled a new $1 trillion stimulus yesterday. I think you could accomplish 100 times as much with a tenth of the money. I would like to see about an $85 billion stimulus.
So is Trump for the kind of infrastructure that you've just been talking about? I think there are some liberal skeptics who say, oh, yeah, he talks about infrastructure, but really all he's going to do is green light pipelines and things like that that the private sector want to build, and it's not going to be public works or public interest infrastructure.
He talks primarily about ports and airports. The pipelines will be approved today, two executive orders, the North Dakota pipeline and XL. But I think he talks mostly about ports and airports, and I think that's fine, but I want more.
He says bridges, railroads, he says that.
Yeah, and those are all fine, but I think your payoff is the Carnegie Library. You know, Andrew Carnegie built 1,600 of those in the United States. They've been repurposed. They're still around. People don't use libraries anymore. Build buildings that serve people, especially
people in New York,
the underclass.
I just have to say, people in New York use libraries a lot.
Yeah, do they? Because in my Carnegie Library in Warren, Ohio, has been repurposed three times, and I spend every Tuesday night, as I write in the Fourth Way, going to that library. And I think if you build brick and mortar, and one of my examples is the Neighborhood Christian Clinic in Phoenix, cost $1 million to build, so serves 14,000 people a year. The old public health model, Brian, works. We ought to go back to delivering health care, not paper, to people.
My guest is Hugh Hewitt. His book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority. And Charlie in Deal, you're on WNYC with Hugh Hewitt. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
Morning, Charlie.
I'm just concerned. I heard a lot of beautiful stuff so far. But how do you – I know you supported Trump and you campaigned for him. How do you feel about the tone of what's going on and the amount of people that it's making them so uncomfortable? Thank you. I'll hang up.
Thank you, Charlie. I think it's a really important question.
It's the question. The more we talk about temperament, the less we talk about tangible Trump trophies. And I'm very uncomfortable. That's why I asked him to step out of the race after the Access Hollywood video. As I said, I am not comfortable with this approach. I have interviewed him a number of times, 15 times on the radio, four debates. In private, he is very different than this public persona. And I believe he will accomplish much, much more to the extent that he limits the explosiveness, the Andrew Jacksonian kind of thunder.
Let me follow up on that, because I think there's a sense of betrayal that a lot of people feel, like maybe especially a lot of women and Muslims and people of color who might feel that a thoughtful conservative like yourself wouldn't find Trump's disparaging of the Khan family and Judge Curiel and women on the Billy Bush tape and, you know, Megyn Kelly and the disabled reporter and the Seventh-day Adventists and pretending not to know who David Duke was and on for the sake of political gain, that that should have all been morally disqualifying to someone like you who seems to have real standards and decency. What would you say to those people?
First, I'd tell them I have my own Trump tattoos. I was insulted publicly by the president in front of 21 million people. And this is the business we have chosen as said in Godfather 3. You just Godfather 2, you just take it and you go along. Number two.
But that's media, like politician to media person. That's different than how vulnerable populations feel.
And vulnerable populations, I think, should watch what he does. I've urged everyone when they go back and reread the inaugural, which is growing on me. The most important thing he said is we will eradicate radical Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth. That's a hard thing to do, but everyone would agree it would be a good thing to do, including Muslims.
Why is that the most important? Because everybody says that, right? I mean, President Bush and President Obama both said we were going to wipe this out, right?
President Obama never actually said it. That was part of the campaign, and people doubted whether or not he had the tenacity to actually carry through the abrupt withdrawal from Iraq, et cetera. But I do believe that the march was a reaction to language. And the march was huge, and the march is significant, and people ought to look at it and say, okay, what do I do? And I said, when he talked about American Carnage, though, Brian, the Oscars came out today. I think the best film of the year is Moonlight by about 1 million yards. And Moonlight is about American Carnage. It is about a neighborhood that I don't go to, that I don't live in, that I try hard to serve through the commissions I serve on. But it is American Carnage to be a gay kid growing up with a crackhead mother. That is American Carnage, to live in that neighborhood that's depicted in that movie. And if Trump can address those problems, will they look past his language to his achievements? I hope they would.
I'm interviewing Michael Moore later, and I was thinking that some of the language, including some of the American carnage and dark portrayals of, you know, rusted out factories and all of that is language that somebody like a Michael Moore could use.
Oh, yes. In fact, Michael Moore, I would like him to describe Warren, Ohio, with its shuttered copper weld U.S. Steel and Republic Steel, with its closed down Packard plant, with GM running on two shifts and not three. What happened to Trumbull and Mahoning County? They've only voted for a Republican twice since 1928. They voted for Hoover. They voted for Richard Nixon in 72, and then they voted for Trump. Why did they do that? Because Michael Moore had the same analysis of the problem, and they think Trump will fix it.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC with Hugh Hewitt. Hi, Judy.
Thank you. I would appreciate Mr. Hewitt's honesty more if he would honestly acknowledge the wall of racism that met President Obama for 8 years. A man standing up during a State of the Union address and shouting, "You lie," and nobody criticized that from the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell swearing to be in opposition for 8 years. And then when Obama does things like adopt a Republican health care plan that was invented by, I understand it, Mitt Romney, everybody shouted Obamacare was the worst thing since the plague. And it's like cooties. Anything Obama said had cooties because he was black. And if Mr. Hewitt can't acknowledge this, I can't believe him about anything else.
I think you do disagree with this.
I do. And Judy, thank you for the call. I do reject that. I only know my own heart, and it's got nothing to do with race that I opposed Obamacare. If you would look up, if you have the time, Judy, Google Hugh Hewitt, The Completion, the column that I wrote about President Obama's swearing in 8 years ago. It was an important triumph for American democracy. It was an important triumph for the 14th Amendment. Much of the opposition to President Obama, I'm not denying there are racists in America. I think they're a small and insignificant number, but I'm not denying that they are there. The opposition to President Obama was based on ideology, not race. And I would point out to the fact that Secretary Powell, Secretary Rice, the whole legacy of the Republican commitment to the civil rights movement that dates back to my state of Ohio, free soil state, and breaking the Southern Democratic bloc on the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, it's just not true that it was based on race. It's based on ideology, a huge difference.
But it's not just Obama's black, I don't like black people. It trickles down, the people who disagree with you would say, to, you know, views like, oh, this Obamacare, it's going to give my tax dollars to a lot of undeserving black people disproportionately when I'd rather it stay in the fund for my Medicare. That might have been a Tea Party position, consciously or subconsciously.
And I would say to them, I hope they read The Fourth Way. Most conservatives, I don't deny there's a nationalist, racist element of about 1% on the margin, just like there's a crazy communist element of about 1% on the margin. And we've got to move away from the amplification of the margins to the center of the debate, which occurs in Congress primarily between the left and the right. And to amplify everything into a debate over race is to do a disservice to those people who are trying to help, regardless of color, ethnicity, religion, background, those who need help.
On Obamacare, you write in the book about the possible transition that you hope for back to free markets in healthcare. But what do you say to criticism that healthcare almost by definition can't work as a free market commodity because the sickest people are so expensive, they'll almost always go broke paying their bills. And that's why whether it's a tax-funded high-risk pool or an individual mandate on the young and healthy so that they buy insurance and put money in the system, government has to play a significant socializing role in the health realm.
I used to regulate the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, my last job in the Reagan administration. It suffered from adverse selection, which is a result of annual open seasons. That meant the sickest people picked the best plans when they got sick. That's not insurance. That's actually a disaster, and we subsidized it heavily. The secret is a national marketplace, and President Trump would talk about erasing the lines. I knew what he meant. He meant one marketplace. You go to Jeff Bezos and say, if you can make 3 billion deliveries in a year, could you design me a website that makes every policy in America available from which no one can be excluded on the basis of pre-existing condition, make it easy to understand, visible, and the pricing apparent. We'll help those people out who can't afford it. It isn't that hard to do, but you must lower the minimum benefit package. You can't make me, as a 60-year-old white male, pay for birth control. I don't need it. I don't want it. And I shouldn't have to pay for it. So I think it will work if the market is actually allowed to form.
But how do you take care of those people who need the help? A lot of Trump voters, right? The stereotype of a Trump voter is like a 55-year-old white guy who's working class and now underemployed. That's a lot of Obamacare-subsidized policyholders.
Means testing credits for the purchase of health care is a huge deal, and it's one of Ryan's ideas. It's one of Tom Price's ideas. I shouldn't be getting a subsidy for my health care, but a lot of people should be. We but just got to make it simple.
That's exactly what Obamacare does. Means testing subsidy for buying insurance.
No. What it does is mandate a huge benefit package on the back of every single participant in the individual pools, which is why, by the way, they're in a death spiral. People will rather pay the tax penalty because they viewed it as an economically beneficial transaction than to get a $6,000 deductible policy.
Let me take one more call for you. It's interesting. Of all the things that you've said, the thing that's really got the phones going is your criticism of President Obama's
of course.
Legacy. So we'll take one more like that. Jack in Highland. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Brian. I don't even know where to begin.
Okay, Jack.
In the first place,
pick a focus point and make
it. Gas is down. The stock market's up. Unemployment is down. There are more people insured in the country than there have ever been. So Mr. Hewitt, your entire premise is demonstrably false from the get-go. And I have one question. Considering all the misogyny, the racism, the hatred that Trump has been preaching, is there any line, sir, that he could cross that would make you not support him? What could he possibly do after what he's already done? Thank you, Brian.
The last chapter of the fourth way is about impeachment. And it is for this reason I included it, because there are guardrails which, if he crosses, Republicans have actually impeached one of their own. Democrats refuse to do so. Republicans actually impeached Richard Nixon for abuse of power. If President Trump were to abuse power, and I do not believe he will, I would expect the Republicans to impeach him, which I hope they don't have to do. But I would say to Jack, just a couple of things, Jack. Aleppo is a word. I sum up the Obama presidency in six words. All right. Leading from behind, red line, and Aleppo. I could substitute JVs for Aleppo.
That's all foreign war policy.
It's all foreign war policy. And the disaster that has befallen the globe as a result of 8 years of Ben Rhodes and Valerie Jarrett and President Obama is profound and will take a long time to dig out. At home, one has to look at underemployment as well as unemployment. There was an interesting question at the press conference yesterday. What's the unemployment rate? And I thought Sean Spicer did a fine job, said it is what the Bureau of Labor Statistics says, but that doesn't tell you the story of underemployment. And I know people who are underemployed. And I think if Andy Pusner is confirmed, you will be shocked at what happens to American labor markets. They will improve so dramatically.
In that impeachment chapter, you cited the David Brooks column just after the election where he said, this is only going to last six months to a year anyway. I could see a scenario, I've mentioned this before too, that because Trump has been so close to the line of the Republicans in Congress turning on him and doing what you did, calling for him to drop out of the race, because he flirts with being so politically toxic that it's really bad for the party, that if something were to come up, I don't know if it's collaborations with the Russians that gets revealed from the campaign or some other sort of racist thing that he does or whatever it is, more than any president I could think of, he enters teetering on the line, you know, around which the Republicans could desert him and
You're
vote for
him. Very perceptive. The Emoluments Clause controversy, which will not have legs with a Republican majority because it is indeed ambiguous what it applies to. George Washington referred to it in his first inaugural address in a way that clearly does not mean fair market transactions with foreign governments. So I think Professor Tribe, with whom I've discussed this, is wrong. Nevertheless, if you lose the Congress in a wipeout in 2018 because you are toxic, they will not hesitate to bring those articles based on the Emolument Clause or any other abuse of power. And that's what I wrote in the fourth way. I want to be very clear-eyed about this. He's got to adapt to what you rightly identified as the thin ice on which he skates.
Later, I'm interviewing Fareed Zakaria, who's among those concerned that Trump will move us toward authoritarian, illiberal democracy, with populism and corporate power both rising, he writes, and community-building power of political parties and the pushback power of the press falling. The thinning out of democracy is a real risk, he says. What do you think?
Fareed's a very smart guy, but I believe in the fourth way, the chapter about judges should allay his fear. When Neil Gorsuch is nominated this week, or David Pryor, or Mike Lee, or any of the 21 An originalist goes onto the bench. When 103 other judges are confirmed under the Reed rule by simple majority, they will all be originalists. They're being advised by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society and Jim DeMint of the Heritage Foundation. Originalists check power. They do not expand it. They do not encourage the use of the pen and the phone as President Obama did. They will rebuke that for him. And he is committed to originalists. And the quickest way to lose his Republican support is to appoint liberal judges. He's not going to do that. So he is going to build the wall that is necessary around executive abuse of power through his own judicial appointments.
Interesting. All right. So I also host a Tuesday night national call-in show starting tonight for the first 100 days of the administration. And it's about getting people out of their bubbles. And I hope you'll come on that show some week and take calls from around the country across political lines.
Anytime, Brian.
For hopefully something more enlightening than debate, which is what the country needs so badly right now. And I appreciate you coming on today.
I appreciate you having me. We run the same show on different networks, and I appreciate your approach.
Hugh Hewitt, his new book is The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. His radio talk show is heard locally on AM 970, and he's an NBC News and MSNBC commentator. Doing any? I don't have a list of personal appearances or anything. Are you doing?
No, I don't do book signings.
No,
I don't do
those. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.